just to be here today for the release of the pre-election line for Scotty. For an election where the economy is going to be the same stage. Now, this is just to summarise our current position. The recovery hasn't been stronger this year than was expected back at the budget, but there are still plenty of headwinds which will have the effect of keeping growth moderate. New Zealand's position as a whole was considerably stronger than in late 2008. We are on course to return to surplus by budget 2014. We remain relatively well placed, mainly due to our strong links with Australia and Asia, despite considerable global uncertainty, and I'll come back to some of the detail of that. It's helpful to reflect on where we started back in 2008. The economy was already in recession for two reasons. One was the New Zealand recession, which began at the start of 2008, which was the consequence of a build-up of pretty severe economic imbalances and loss of competitiveness. And that was then compounded by the global recession that followed from Lehman's in late 2008. But New Zealand before that was already headed for some challenges. And at the time, the forecasts were for permanent deficits, ever-rising debt. Government spending had risen by 50% in 5 years. And while we were on a path of rapidly growing foreign debt, particularly in the household sector. You've seen this picture before, which is an updated one, summarising the imbalances that built up in the economy, pointing to a very significant decline in the performance of the internationally competitive parts of the economy. In fact, an unprecedented decline, particularly pronounced in tourism, but also in manufacturing. So from about 2004, the New Zealand tradable sector actually shrank, while the non-tradable part of the economy, that is the bit that's not competing internationally, continued to grow. You've heard the story about growth, which was coming from all the wrong places, from government, household borrowing, property speculation, while exports went backwards. And you can also see in this updated graph that progress on rebalancing has some way to go yet. So we've focused at the same time as managing through the recession, we focused on putting in place the building blocks of a competitive economy. These have been discussed at some length over recent years. Infrastructure growth, major change in the tax system to encourage work and saving, a long-term program to lift the efficiency of the public sector, cutting low-quality red tape and assisting business, more free trade agreements, and a strong long-term focus on building skills. Despite the challenges of the recession and the earthquake, we've made some progress. We have had growth, I think, for 9 of the last 10 quarters in the economy. We are on track to surplus in 3 years. And net crown debt is forecast to peak below 30% of GDP, a target we talked about back in the budget, and which we continue to meet in these forecasts. Government spending is just beginning to fall as a percentage of GDP, having grown quite rapidly over the last 2 or 3 years. And our external liabilities, which are our most significant vulnerability, have fallen from 85% of GDP to about 70%, but by international standards are still too high and will take some time to get down to internationally satisfactory levels. So here are the forecasts, which you'll be now familiar with. They've changed somewhat from the budget. Interestingly, in the budget, Treasury was a bit too pessimistic about the shorter term prospects for the economy. There's been 43,000 net new jobs in the past year, 20,000 more than was forecast at the budget. The negative impact of the earthquake has not been quite as great as was initially feared. Commodity prices remain reasonably high, although they are expected to come off somewhat over the next year, supporting growth. Treasury now expects the rebuild of Canterbury to take a bit longer to get going, reflecting the continuation of seismic activity. So the slower start, combined with the prospect of renewed weakness in some parts of the world economy, means our forecasting growth will peak slightly lower than forecast in the budget next year. However, it's coming off a higher base, that is, a base economy a bit bigger than they expected. So growth in the March year will be about 3.4%. So you're looking at an average of around 3% growth over the next 4 years. The effect of that is that the fall in unemployment is roughly what was expected back at the budget. Back then, Treasury predicted an extra 170,000 new jobs over the forecast period, the 20,000 ahead of that, now forecasting about the same kind of growth, 150,000 new jobs, which brings the unemployment rate under 5% by 2013. Of course, the speed at which Canberra rebuild gathers momentum will matter a lot to employment, as will the impact of the inevitable skill shortages around a rebuild of that size, and the effect that that might have across the cross wages and the rest of the economy. Inflation is also forecast to remain below 3% a year from early 2012. As you'll be aware, the current figure, I think there's one published today, at 4.6-4.7%, still includes the 2.2% adjustment for GST. That will drop out from the next quarter, and headline inflation rate will be back to around 3% once the GST effect drops out. The white line here is the forecasts as they were put forward to the incoming government before budget 2009. By the series of decisions the government's made over a number of years, but particularly in the 2011 budget, that was the budget forecast then, and the surplus that's expected, well, the track that's expected in this pre-election update is fairly similar. The forecast deficit for the current year at $10.8 billion is a bit higher than at the budget, and that's to do with the shift in earthquake costs. Some of the costs that we had expected to count in the deficit last year, the last financial year, were too uncertain, and so they've been rolled forward, and it's largely to do with local government infrastructure. What that means is if those numbers have been a bit harder, the deficit that we announced a month or so ago would have been another $1.2 billion higher, so up over $19 billion. $1.2 billion that has shifted, and that explains why the deficit this year will be a bit higher than it was in the budget. However, it will reduce quickly from now. So in 12-13, it's looking at dropping from 10.8 this year to 4.4 billion the next year, 900 million the year after that. So essentially it halves and then halves again, and then it's about 900 million before getting into surplus in budget 2014. So while the overall forecasts are fairly similar, but because of any number of events, there are unders and overs. So tax revenue is down a bit, driven primarily by lower forecasts for trade and partner growth and lower interest rates. So lower interest rates flow through to the resident withholding tax, and it's actually quite a significantly lower interest rate. So these are offset by lower benefit payments due to faster than expected decline in unemployment. And the lower interest rates provide a benefit to the Crown finance costs. There's also a bit of shifting around in levies. We announced a couple of weeks ago a reduction in the ACC levy of around $700 million. That comes directly off our fiscal track. So $700 million less that the government collects. And there's also been other changes with the EQC levy. We will collect about $170 million more. And the emissions trading scheme, whose accounting is complex and keeps generating sometimes unpredictable impacts on our fiscal track. This pre-election update confirms the government's operating allowances of $800 million new discretionary spending for each of the next couple of budgets. From budget 2014 on, that will grow to $1.2 billion. And I want to stress just how demanding the task will be to achieve that fiscal, to achieve that surplus target. The government laid out in budget 2011 a fairly tough budget. And the impact of that budget will start being felt significantly in the next financial year, that is from mid-2012, particularly in parts of the public sector. So reaching that surplus is going to be quite a big challenge. However, we've spent a couple of years getting our policy settings right and getting the public sector in the right frame of mind and re-skilled so that it will be able to achieve the pretty tight expenditure that they've been allocated. Because we're on track to surplus, we're also on track with our net debt. We've set a target, an informal target, I suppose, of keeping that net debt under 30% of GDP. In a world where every element of debt, sovereign and private, is under tough scrutiny from the markets, we want to make sure that we keep our sovereign debt in, keep us in a category where it's regarded as no problem and doesn't need to be examined. And so keeping under that 30% is pretty important. In fact, the peak is just slightly lower in these projections than they were in the than they were in the budget. We've talked in the past about the New Zealand's external indebtedness. There's a number of ways of looking at this. One is the current account. In the near term, the current account is supported by the high terms of trade and a temporary boost from the Rugby World Cup. So you can see we're tracking for the last couple of years at around 3% instead of around 8% for the 3 or 4 years before that. However, it widens to almost 7% of GDP by 2016. I might say the projections beyond 2016 show it improving fairly significantly. That trade balance worsening is driven by a high exchange rate and by the earthquake rebuilding. If we take out the extra investment associated with the earthquake, the current account deficit would be around 5% of GDP. So that represents some progress from at its worst around 8%, one of the biggest current account deficits in the developed world, to a base level of around 5% if we take the earthquake factor out of it. But of course it is still not good enough, and that's why this economy has some way to go to make the structural adjustments necessary to reduce our vulnerability to external debt. The good news is that household and national saving is forecast to continue rising. That fairly drastic, fairly dramatic improvement in saving is offset by a faster growth in investment spending, of which the rebuild in Canterbury is one component, and the other, of course, is the investment spending that will be done by businesses in a growing economy. So, while the current account deficit is going to go up, components of it are investment-focused rather than driven by consumption. And international liabilities are forecast to remain around 70% of GDP under 2014, and then to widen out somewhat in association with the flows related to the current account deficit. Again, our external liabilities still represent a significant vulnerability for this economy, and in the longer term, higher savings and a stronger focus on competitiveness, a stronger export sector, are the only way that is going to come, only way it's going to come right. We've also set out to improve the management of the government's very large balance sheet. There's been some discussion of this in the context of the mixed ownership model. In the past year, our balance of our assets has increased from $223 billion to $245 billion and is forecast to increase by about another $22 billion to $267 billion in 2016. It's a very large pool of assets, and we are determined to continue to improve the effective management of that taxpayer's capital. And that's the context in which we will be, if we are re-elected, reallocating existing capital to higher priorities. And the mixed ownership model enables us, would enable us if we are elected and can put it into place, to shift somewhere around $5 to $7 billion from those energy companies while still retaining majority ownership to other high priority uses without extra borrowing, and I stress that. If we are able to execute the mixed ownership model, then that's $5 to $7 billion that we won't be going to overseas markets to borrow. A lot of discussion about the global context in which the pre-election update has been put together. And there's certainly some concerns about the global context. Since the budget, Treasury's forecast of trading partner growth have been revised downwards by a total of about 2% over the next 4 years, and are pretty much in line with the IMF forecasts released in September. This has been something of a moving feast. Forecasts, even as recent as July, are really out of date. So then the downward revision is most evident in developed countries. Australia and Asia will be affected, but to a lesser extent. And some of them, such as Australia, some of their trading partners are actually expected to bounce back from their current position. So the weaker outlook is expected to result in these forecasts in about a 10% fall in commodity prices in the next year, export growth volume of less than 2% per annum through 2013, and some increased funding costs for banks. With respect to export volume growth, and that's quite an important point, export volume growth has at times in the past, for about 15 years from 1990 through to 2005, was around 4% per year. So our export volume growth at the moment is at a low level. These pre-election update forecasts take into account the fact that our trading partners will be weaker, our exchange rate will remain relatively high, and therefore by historical standards we will have quite low export growth, even though the terms of trade are very high. The global situation, of course, is largely out of our control, and that simply reinforces the importance of the government focusing on those areas which it can control directly and on minimising our risk in these stormy global waters by minimising our borrowing requirement. Just to give you a sense of the change in balance of our exports, this is not a new story, but the momentum continues. We get a lot of bad news out of the US and Europe about the downturn in their economies. Germany's just revised its growth forecast down again. But the US, Japan, US, UK and Germany account for about 11% of our exports. So they're certainly accounting for a lot more than 11% of our news. So we've just got to keep this in perspective. It's not to say there aren't risks with the sort of China-Australia train to which we are hooked. Of course there are. But even in China, when they talk about growth falling back, they're talking about it falling from 11% to 7.5%. So yes, China may well slow down. That would affect Australia and would affect us. We have just a little bit of confidence, but not overconfidence, that the food-related prices, even in that scenario, will be a bit more stable than the prices for coal and iron ore, on which Australia is particularly dependent. And this outlines the terms of trade picture. You don't want to pick the trend in terms of trade quarter to quarter, but there is a reasonable picture here over 10 years of a rising terms of trade. The increase in the terms of trade since in recent times have put something like $8 billion more income into the economy. So the difference between the decade average and the current terms of trade represents about $8 billion of income. And through the recession, that has been a very important support to this economy. And it will continue to be a very important support to our growth over the next few years. But it is vital that we underpin that with a strong focus on competitiveness. Because over the last 10 years, we've lost competitiveness. Our export sector has shrunk, and we need to restore it. I talked earlier about household savings. They are definitely improving. In fact, the uplift here in the graph on the left-hand side is the most rapid increase in household savings that we can find in the last 30 years, at least. People have got the message. They are borrowing less. In fact, credit growth is between 0 and 2%. They're being careful with their spending, and they are increasing their savings. Income growth is expected to exceed credit growth over the next few years, which will lead to further declines in the measure of household debt on the right-hand side. Personally, I think the forecasts are a wee bit pessimistic there, because I think New Zealanders have got the message that having less debt relative to their current incomes is a very good idea, not just a little bit of a good idea. But we'll have to see how that unfolds over the next few years. The change in savings behaviour is forecast to continue, driven by several factors. One is the need to rebuild wealth that's been lost through finance company failures, where there was $8 billion of cash savings lost, falls in property values, and the falls in value of other financial assets. And this is a pattern around the developed world. People are responding to loss in value of their savings by increasing their savings. Government policy settings that encourage savings, such as the tax switch, the increase in the KiwiSaver contribution in 2013, in the short term, of course, increased saving will have a dampening effect on the economy, but in the longer term, it's vital to a stronger platform for growth. When you look at the change in household savings there, it's hard to see just what you could do that would make it move faster than it already is. So people are making the adjustments. We also expect interest rates to stay lower for longer. This helps households with their debt problem and helps them increase their savings. Interest rates are at 45-year lows, and of course they're much lower than they were back in 2008 when floating mortgage rates were over 10%. The sovereign credit downgrades by two rating agencies has had no effect so far on mortgage rates. Yields on New Zealand government bonds have risen slightly, but when you look across the world, everyone's yields have risen. And the margin between ours and the US benchmark rate is the same now as it was before the credit downgrade. So it's just a bit hard to untangle the effects of global movements in interest rates on the one hand, and any effects that might pertain particularly to New Zealand. But there doesn't appear to have been any impact on mortgage interest rates. So looking ahead, the main challenges are pretty straightforward. Getting back to surplus, as I said, that will be a challenge. Forecasting it doesn't guarantee it. Doing it is what does it. Rebuilding competitiveness in this economy in order to get our export sector up and running after 6 or 7 years of deteriorating performance. And of course, to ensure that flows through, that success flows through into sustainable jobs and higher incomes. This election is going to be largely about the economy. The update shows that the government has the plan that will deliver more jobs, will deliver 3% growth over the next 4 years, a surplus in budget 2014, and less borrowing. Other parties are going to need to show just how they can afford new policies without more borrowing, and how their policies are going to reinforce a competitive economy with a growing export sector rather than a larger government. Any questions?
These forecasts show that there's a downside risk of 1 in 5 of a $25 billion hole if our current market doesn't come right now out the road. Do you see that as a real risk to these forecasts?
Well, the Treasury's put a 1 in 5 assessment on it. There's probably a 1 in 20, a 1 in 30 chance of a meltdown like 2008. And that's why everyone's watching the European situation so carefully. So yes, we're well aware of those risks. We think we're in reasonable shape to handle them. We're very committed to the 2014 budget surplus. Of course, if there's some kind of meltdown, then you would expect us to handle it in a similar way to 2008-09, and that is to protect the vulnerable, maintain public services, but stick to a long-term view about lifting our economic prospects. So, we're getting better at handling these rough global seas.
To handle it, doesn't that mean more borrowing?
What's that?
To handle it, doesn't it mean more borrowing?
Well, we would avoid that if at all possible. We're very, very committed to the surplus in budget 2014. And in these, in this update, there's an 80% chance that the way things turn out for the global economy will support these forecasts. There's a chance that it won't. We would adjust to that if that's how it happens. But we'll be sticking to that 2014 surplus, barring some kind of meltdown or other catastrophe.
Just look at Christchurch, $20 billion, which is pretty as high as $30 billion. How realistic is that? And is that covered by private insurance? Is
Yeah, I think the 20 billion is pretty realistic. The 30 billion looks to me to be a bit improbable. About just over half of it is insurance funded, and the other half of it is government funded if you include EQC, which has got access, of course, to some insurance. The insurance market is loosening up there. I think as the weeks go by, we're seeing the insurance market come back to life, and I don't think that that will be a long-term constraint. We probably need to focus as much on things like the City Council planning for the CBD, getting the building standards, getting the consenting processes working. If we can get all that working, then I'm pretty relaxed that the insurance companies will be in the market.
Can you explain why the training centre has actually gotten worse compared to the non-training centre in the last 3 years?
Yeah, well, if you look at the export numbers, tourism has been hardest hit by the sustained period of a high exchange rate. That turned out to be the most exchange rate sensitive. Other parts of the export sector are going pretty well, like the primary production and manufacturing has been growing moderately off the back of a good exchange rate with Australia. So that's the export story. On the non-tradable side, the fact is that when you look at this, at the government's budgets, we've been spending through a recession to support public services, income support. It's really in the last budget that we've signalled a fiscal tightening. And over the next 3 years, that'll be the most rapid fiscal consolidation New Zealand has seen for quite some time. So we're just moving into a phase where the non-tradable sector is going to come under pressure from much tighter government spending.
Do you think that you can really improve that imbalance without a change in your monetary and exchange rate policies?
Well, a 70-cent exchange rate would make the job a lot easier. And the market can't seem to quite make up its mind about that. I think we saw the exchange rate go from 75 cents to 80 cents in 12 days. So they couldn't quite decide whether to push it to 70 or pull it back up to 80. So New Zealand and that will fluctuate between being seen as a small commodity-related risky economy some days and a safe haven from potential catastrophe in Europe on other days. And we can't control that. To change that balance, we have to focus on what we can control, which is our underlying competitiveness. Where regardless of the exchange rate, we're attracting resources into a faster-growing export sector. I don't think there is any one simple shot with monetary policy to change it. If there was, we would have fired.
If tax revenue is less than forecast, and that 14-15 target for surplus doesn't look like it's going to happen, are you saying that you will cut spending further rather than let that surplus be achieved perhaps a year later?
Oh, we are committed to the surplus in budget 2014. Of course, not at all costs, but you would need to see a very significant change in, say, the global outlook and therefore tax revenues for us to shift off that. With respect to tax revenues, I mean, it's up and down between the forecasts and collections for reasons like, for instance, IRD and Treasury have different views about the size of the company losses out there and what people will do with those losses, and that accounts for a significant, reasonably significant difference between the two forecasts. So we would see fluctuations in the tax revenue as a reason to give away the surplus. You know, if you've got 3 to 3.5% growth, your tax revenue is going to be growing, and that will certainly help us get there. Well, look, we're just observing what we see. And I think what we're seeing around credit ratings and interest rates is an unusual period, the most unusual period probably since the Second World War. I mean, just last week, one of the agencies was warning France, which has been a triple A for a long time, that they face the prospect of some kind of negative watch or downgrade. And so you've got triple A sovereigns coming into question. You have the US downgraded. You've got the lowest sovereign, lowest bond yields in 50 years. In fact, I think in the US, it went out 1.8%. They were the lowest ever going back to the 1700s. So those global pressures that are pushing interest rates down seem to be overwhelming any upward pressures you get from a downgrade of New Zealand at least. Some of those European sovereigns are suffering quite large increases in their bond yields, even though they haven't been downgraded. And it's just a very confusing picture. All we know is there's been no effect yet on mortgage rates, and what we're paying for government debt has fluctuated a bit, but the estimates of an impact like 0.1, 0.2% look to be somewhere in the range.
But does it mean that government didn't need to apologize for any more
efforts agencies? No, it doesn't mean that at all. I think it just means we're in extraordinary circumstances at the moment around this bit of the economy, that is sovereign interest rates, which means it hasn't had the kind of direct impact it might have. If we had this downgrade, say, back in 2008, I think it could have had a very significant impact. And it may be the case in another year or two when these circumstances have changed. So I don't think it's any reason for complacency at all.
You've got a 1% better growth rate over 5 years to what you had back in the budget, which given what we know, the global backdrop as well as some of the news around it for the FNC, that doesn't quite feel right. This, I suppose, going through this, is the downside scenario looking a little bit more likely than the central scenario?
Well, I think Treasury has put a 20% rating on the downside scenario. We're taking the view that a combination of the Christchurch earthquake rebuild, which has to happen, and reasonable prospects for our export prices, even if there's some global fluctuation in growth, means that we've got a reasonable chance of a moderate growth through the next 2 or 3 years, backed by policy settings which are pushing in the right direction around savings and investment and competitiveness. So we know those risks are there, but we're not directing our whole policy at them. We're directing our policy at a positive, forward-looking, competitive, export-driven economy while managing those risks. And we've gone to quite a lot of trouble around managing the risks because they're pretty well known, through, for instance, strengthening banking capital requirements, introducing the open bank resolution policy progressively if we're re-elected, and making sure that our financial markets have been almost completely re-regulated. So I think we're managing the risks reasonably well at the same time as focusing on the positive opportunities for growth, because those opportunities are quite significant.
And we're forecasting a massive bounce back in residential investment in particular, which is obviously around Christchurch largely, but I mean, are you expecting capacity constraints to be a problem there in terms of workforce and inflation and so forth?
Yes, there will be capacity constraints around the construction sector. In fact, it could be quite significant. And the sector itself has initiated discussions among themselves and with government about what steps we can take to do it. We're quite active on it, but the inflow of that new housing has been very low. At some stage you expect it to pick up. Hasn't happened yet, but it's bound to happen.
What sort of measures are you contemplating taking with the industry?
Well, I wouldn't want to get ahead of where they're up to, but there was a report last week that indicated some of them. I think one of the more important ones is for the industry to get right into the pipeline of young people who have choices about where they go. You know, I think, that, in my view, they haven't been nearly active enough. So we're doing our bit by rationalising qualifications pathways so young people know exactly where to go if they want to go into the construction industry, out of school, and ensuring that there's a basic standard of literacy and numeracy for every young Kiwi who wants to make that choice.
Do you think that the political party should detail which policies they would pursue if we have the downside scenario? So which cuts they would make, which taxes they would increase, what they would do? And would National come up with their policies?
Oh, we haven't done that, and we're not proposing to do it. I think it's certainly all parties have to demonstrate how they're going to get to surplus and reduce borrowing. I think that's the bottom line, and no one else has reached that standard yet. I think we've shown a track record of resilience and pragmatism around managing shocks because we've had more than our fair share of them.
But shouldn't voters expect to know what the government would do if there's a downside scenario, given for the last 4 years since we've only had downside scenarios?
Well, I don't agree with that. I mean, despite the shocks, actually the economy's grown for 9 of the last 10 quarters. It's currently at a higher growth rate than Australia, and we've got reasonably good prospects for moderate growth over the next year or two. So, as I said before, we are focusing on that positive opportunity and managing the risks, and we've got a good track record on it. We haven't gone to the step of, you know, detailing exactly what would happen if there was a billion less revenue. We know that's a risk. We actually need to be 2 or 3 billion less to make much difference to us, to our plans. But we haven't gone to that, haven't gone through that. Oh, well, it's the reality of what's been happening over the last few years. I expect it's likely to turn around over the next couple of years. There's a study I've heard quoted, and I've actually found it yet, that says that the New Zealand labour market is more sensitive to the Australian infrastructure boom than the Australian labour market is. That is, if you're in New Zealand, you're more likely to shift there than if you're in New South Wales. You're more likely to go to Perth. So New Zealand labour market's been responding to that, plus some outflow from Christchurch, which has been, I mean, that's been disappointing but understandable.
I think that in March 2021
year will be the next after 1,000 per year. Is it favour of
government on
that front? Pretty low, your government quite a big deal about this issue, and now we have now there's something worse than Toronto. Yeah, well, I think the reason for that's pretty obvious. Australia didn't have a recession, we had a big one. And we've set about the task of fundamentally changing those dynamics, and we believe we're making some progress.
The
that's laid out in budget 2011. So most government departments won't be getting any more money over the next 2 or 3 years. Health and education will still continue to get reasonably small increases, but they all need to rethink how they're delivering public services, because our objective is to continue to deliver better services, but do so at less cost. And I don't think there'll be any part of government that will be unaffected by the need to focus on better services for less costs. And we've spent quite a bit of time in the last 2 years focusing on fast-growing cost areas, which were law and order and welfare, and we're bringing in reform programs in both of those, which we have confidence in, and if we are elected, we will implement. And we focus a lot on changing the culture in the public service so that it is willing and able to execute significant change over the next 3 or 4 years. And we've got quite a lot, we've got a growing confidence in their capacity to do that.
The pretty good, what's that, a sustainable growth rate, in 2.5% a year, and seems to make no assumption of much improvement in labour productivity for more than, say, 1% a year through 2026. Doesn't that indicate that the Treasury doesn't think that the stage of the government is not adding up to actually make the economy grow as fast as these things are quite scaled to me?
Well, why don't the Cabinet have done everything they said they should do? That's not unusual for a government. They're taking a professional and conservative view about what can be achieved, but it tells you that we have to do, we have to keep at considered and consistent reform over time if we're going to increase our productivity growth and improve our competitiveness. But I think most New Zealanders know that. Their income, growth in their incomes is going to increasingly depend on our ability to sell more products and services to the rest of the world in a more competitive way, because their incomes are not going to grow off the back of more credit, booming housing markets and fast growing government. And I think they all understand that challenge, and to some extent this election is about that challenge, about the willingness and ability to take the public along with the kind of changes we need to make in this economy to succeed. Any more questions?
You mentioned the savings from the deficit payments, which were one of the figures. I wonder if you've got any aspirational target for this more expected cost and savings from the benefits reform process through the government sector now?
We're still in the early stages of working out what could be achieved from the welfare reform package that we're putting together. But we would be hoping to have some fairly aspirational targets in that respect. This is the investment approach we're talking about, where we want to set up the public institutions so that they can make good decisions about spending more now to prevent large long-term costs, such as a young person going on a benefit and staying there for 10 or 15 years, which represents a very large long-term cost. Some shorter-term investment in their education could make a big difference to that. We're still in relatively early stages.
So there's no numbers at this stage for what you're expecting in the first year of that process?
No, they're not. The closest we've got there is some work we've done around the package that was announced by the Prime Minister back in August, focusing on the under 18 sole parents. And that's a fairly significant investment, actually, in 2,500 young New Zealanders, in order to avoid the large long-term costs that can go with long-term welfare dependency from starting on a benefit very young. But again, we're just in the process of changing the way we look at the problem and the way we account for it. Because the way we've done it traditionally has limited governance options and aspirations. And if we're re-elected, we'll certainly be expanding the options and aspirations.
One question for me. We're looking at much lower costs of borrowing now than ever before. And as the cost of borrowing lowers, are we looking at losing more out of the sale of assets, which are currently returning sort of in excess of 10% per annum? I mean, the economic rationale for selling assets, if borrowing is very cheap, is not that strong. Would you disagree?
No, the economic rationale is pretty strong. I mean, these things all move together. If you look in the CPI today, you'll see that the electricity prices have actually dropped for, I think, what's only the third quarterly episode in 10 years. So that's also reducing the potential return of the SOEs. We're quite confident that when you, particularly once you strip out the special dividends paid by SOEs, that the mathematics of it line up fine. The economics, I think, of mixed ownership model are quite positive.
You said that some of the questions would apply that there's a 20% chance of the downside scenario, but I really think it should be one that says that there's at least at least a 1 in 5 chance of outcome worse than that captured in the downside scenario. So are you saying that there's 50% on the downside of the remainder of the main scenario, or is it some other outcome?
Look, you need to talk to Treasury about just how they've worked their probabilities. We've taken the approach that we have some very positive opportunities to grow this economy off the back of superior and competitive export performance in the faster growing economies to which we are now strongly linked. And we've been focusing on that at the same time as managing the risks. Now, there's some risk of catastrophe. Lehman's showed us that. The Europeans might go completely off their nuts, do something really stupid, and we have a meltdown next week. I think that's a relatively low risk. There's more probability that they will muddle through, that global growth will be lower, but not really low. And that's a good enough environment for a resilient economy driven by sensible policies to do reasonably well.
Just on the limit zone for
Well, we haven't got ahead of ourselves because we put this proposition up as one that will go to the people in the election. And we would only make detailed assessments about that if we were elected. Against that, we're confident that there'd be significant retail interest. Now, just how much, that's something we would have a close look at if we were elected.
Sorry,
Margaret,
time's
up
here.
Right, any other questions? Thank you very much.